Hi, this is Nicholas Hammond, the original Peter Parker, the Amazing Spider-Man, and you're listening to Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life.
Welcome, comic book fans. This is Comic Book Central. I'm your host, Joe Stuber. Thanks for joining me here in the lair. I hope you had an incredible week. I know I had an incredibly busy one, but it was amazingly entertaining. I took a little break from talking about comic books to talk about Abbott and Costello and monsters with Derek Cook over at MonsterKidRadio.net. We continued our series on the Meet the Monsters movies with Abbott and Costello Meet the Invisible Man. Both parts of the conversation are now online. Be sure to check those out on MonsterKidRadio.net and stay tuned for our next movie in the series. I got right back into talking about comic books with my podcasting partner Keith Voss over on theindycast.com, where we're celebrating our third anniversary on the podcast. Oh, has it been that long? Wow. We're celebrating our third anniversary with our review of the final issue of Marvel Comics, The Further Adventures of Indiana Jones. That episode will be online and on iTunes June 16th. If you're not familiar with the IndyCast, take a listen.
Tune in each fortnight to the IndyCast, the world's number one Indiana Jones fan podcast.
Trust me.
Featuring the latest news, reviews, and interviews with on-screen and behind-the-scenes talent who helped bring to life the greatest adventure movie series ever made. Each episode has the latest from the world of Indiana Jones, as well as interactive segments, trivia, contests, and specials, including radio dramas and music retrospectives. The IndyCast.
It's a transmitter. It's a radio for speaking to God.
Available in iTunes or listen directly at theindycast.com.
If adventure has a name, it must be the IndyCast.
Now, since we finished up our reviews of the Marvel Comics series, Keith and I will also talk about the future of our segment on the IndyCast. And we're announcing the winners of our great Further Adventures giveaway, so you don't want to miss any of that. And if that wasn't enough comic booky goodness for the week, my wife and I also got a chance to visit the beautiful Ohio Theater in downtown Columbus, where they kicked off their summer movie series with none other than my favorite comic book movie of all time, Superman the Movie. Oh, it must have been 35 years since the last time I saw it on the big screen, and I'm telling you, it was the best. Watching it with a theater full of super fans, seeing the little kids there and little Superman shirts, the next generation of Superman the Movie fans. Oh man, that was amazing. Everyone laughed in all the right spots. The people were cheering the rescues. The music was incredible, of course. John Williams' score. Good stuff. Loved it. If you're in the Columbus area, be sure to check out Kappa.com, C-A-P-A.com, for more information on the theater and the summer movie series. They're also going to be including the Harold Lloyd silent film classic Girl Shy, complete with a live musical accompaniment by the brilliant Clark Wilson on the Mighty Morton pipe organ. That's one of the few theater pipe organs in the world still in its original home. Ah, man, great stuff. Loved hearing him play the John Williams Superman theme on it the other night. Speaking of Superman the movie, that hit in the late 70s, and another one of my favorite comic book theme projects that appeared around the same time was the hit CBS TV show The Amazing Spider-Man. Now, I've been running the coaxial cables and firing up the VCR here in the lair. That's right, I have a VCR here in the lair. If you're not sure what that is, kids, ask your parents. They'll tell you what that is. That's right, I still got my old VHS copies of the show, and I've been checking them out in preparation for a visit from my special guest today, the star of The Amazing Spider-Man, Nicholas Hammond. Spider-Man was created by writer Stan the Man Lee and artist Steve Ditko, and he first appeared in Amazing Fantasy issue number 15 back in 1962. A few years later, the Amazing Arachnid was brought to life in an animated series, and he was web-swinging across television sets with a catchy theme song behind him. Now, the swingin' 70s brought us a live-action Spidey in the form of Danny Segrin on the children's television series The Electric Company. Now, don't get me wrong, as a kid, I loved reading Marvel Comics' Spidey super stories and watching Spidey mix it up with crazy villains like Morgan Freeman's Dracula. But on The Electric Company, the web-slinger's heroic acts were kind of limited to drawings. There was no Peter Parker, and Outside of word balloons, Spidey couldn't speak. No, it would take the CBS network to bring the wall crawler to life in a big way with the two-hour TV movie Spider-Man, starring Nicholas Hammond as the first live-action Peter Parker. Now, Nicholas brought an impressive acting background to the role. He made his debut the year after Spidey's in the 1963 film Lord of the Flies. Just 2 short years later, Nicholas landed the role for which he is remembered fondly today, Friedrich von Trapp. He was one of the 7 Von Trapp children in the smash hit musical The Sound of Music, starring his acting inspiration, the incomparable Julie Andrews. He then guest starred on some of the biggest TV series of the day, including The Waltons, Hawaii Five-O, Magnum P.I., and of course, who could forget his appearance as Doug Simpson on the classic Brady Bunch episode, The Subject Was Noses. He was the jock who dumped Marcia when she got hit in the face with a football. It was no wonder then that Nicholas was cast as university student Peter Parker, who was bitten by a radioactive spider, granted superpowers, and was always trying to make ends meet by snapping pictures for J. Jonah Jameson at the Daily Bugle. Now, some have said the TV series deviated too much from the comics, and that may be true on some level, but the show did feature Spidey Sense, real, not organic web shooters, the Spider Tracer, a spider clone, and some spectacular wall-crawling and web-swinging scenes from the late, great stuntman Fred Waugh. No CGI, folks. Those scenes are real. Real stunts and a realistic Peter Parker from Nicholas Hammond, and you've got the ingredients for a really good superhero series. Well, my guest today started out as a child actor and scored one of the biggest musicals to hit the screen. He guest starred in some of the most watched television series of all time, and not counting The Electric Company, he was the first actor to portray the Amazing Spider-Man on a live-action series. He is Nicholas Hammond. Nicholas, welcome to Comic Book Central.
Thank you, Joe. It's a pleasure to be here.
Have you ever seen The Electric Company version of Spider-Man?
You know, I haven't. I've seen the films that were made after we did the series, but I've never seen the Electric Company version. I kind of went into playing Peter Parker wanting to be kind of as uninfluenced by anything else as I could. I had conversations, of course, with Stan Lee and with other people connected with Marvel, but because I wanted to really make Peter as much a real person as possible, and I think that's something that is continued in the later films, I thought, well, I'm not going to allow myself to be overly influenced by what kind of storylines he may have had, either in the comics themselves or in any other kind of animated version they've had of him.
Yeah, I don't think you're in any danger watching The Electric Company. I think you fought The Wall in one episode.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, plus you were the first one with dialogue, too. So,
I think that's why they wanted an actor. I mean, frankly, because I think their attitude was, well, you know, we can always get somebody who does stunts, but, you know, they wanted to do a show in which you, for 80% of the show, it's Peter, and it's only 20% as Spider-Man. So obviously for that 80%, they wanted someone who could interact with the rest of the cast and the storyline could follow through. And I have to say, I really, really enjoyed doing it. It was something totally out of my comfort zone. I had never done anything related to superheroes before, but once I got involved in the show, I just had a great time. I'm very, very pleased I had the opportunity to do it.
Well, I can't imagine them finding a better actor at the time for that.
That's very kind of you. Thanks.
I'm curious to find out, though, when fans approach you, what are you asked about most? The Sound of Music, Spider-Man, or kicking Marcia Brady to the curb?
It's very funny you would say that, because it's amazing how many people remember that episode of the Brady Bunch. I mean, it is
classic.
It is absolutely, and I think I can probably give it, if you really wanted it in percentages, I would say 50% Sound of Music, 25% Spider-Man, 25% Brady Bunch. And of course, it depends on who you are and who they are. If it's a woman, it's going to be more likely it's going to be Brady Bunch or Sound of Music. If it's a guy, it's probably going to be Spider-Man.
That's great. I mean, when you think about that, that is one of the most iconic performances. Just a one shot, you came on as Doug Simpson.
That's right.
This was the one where, in case our listeners haven't seen it though, Marcia Brady gets whacked in the nose with a football, and you were supposed to go out with her, but then all of a sudden something suddenly came up, right?
Something suddenly came up, and that phrase.
Kind of a jerk in this thing.
Oh, absolutely, a big jerk. But of course, so is she. I mean, that's the moral of the story. She's dumped the nice, nerdy guy who wanted to ask her out for me, and then, of course, it backfires on her. So there was a little moral in there, and then they did a Broadway show of Brady Bunch, and that was the particular episode they used. And so other actors have contacted me about playing Doug Simpson. So I thought, gee, it's amazing, because between Peter Parker and Friedrich von Trapp and Doug Simpson, I've had all these people constantly over the years, whether they're in another production of The Sound of Music or if they're a Spider-Man fan. And so I feel very lucky that I've done well. And then there's Lord of the Flies as well. And that's
true. I wanted to ask you about that. Now, that was your first screen role?
It was my first job.
How old were you?
I was 11. No, I was 10 and a half. I turned 11 while we were making the film. Yeah, so wow. It was my first audition ever, and it was the first job I got, and, you know, obviously the first movie, and we filmed for 10 weeks in Puerto Rico, and I just thought, what a great way to make a living. I love this. So
Right out of the gate.
That's right. I know, it was really fun. You know, I did a picture not that long ago with Patrick Dempsey, who, you know, is a wonderful actor and been, you know, on his own series now for a number of years in the States. And I remember we were just about to do our first scene together, and Patrick was just kind of looking at me. And I finally said, well, what are you looking at? And he said, you know, your first two movies were The Sound of Music and Lord of the Flies. He said, my first movie was Meatballs 3.
He's kind of putting it into perspective then, wasn't he?
I never thought about how lucky I was to get my start in two things that would then go on to become absolute classics, you know, forever.
That's not typical for a child actor, though, right?
It sure isn't. And I had a great life as a child actor. I mean, you know, there's seven of us from The Sound of Music. We still see each other a lot. And we talk about how fortunate we were, because you do hear stories of some child actors where it hasn't gone well for them afterwards. And the seven of us, we are still very, very close friends. All seven of us have led, you know, really interesting and positive lives. And, you know, we're happy people. And so we just feel lucky that we were in a film that has given so much pleasure to so many people.
Oh, generation after generation. I mean, it just keeps going on. I mean, it's just amazing. So was Julie Andrews your inspiration to become an actor?
She was, really. She really was. I had seen her on stage when I was 9, when she was in My Fair Lady in London. And so it was not long after that that the opportunity came to audition for Lord of the Flies, and I probably wouldn't have wanted to do it if I hadn't seen that. So yes, in many ways, she really was. She was the beginning of it all, and that's why it was so wonderful 50 years later to be able to tour the Southern Hemisphere with her and do that two-person show together, and it was. It was just magical.
Yeah, this was an evening with Julie Andrews. You wrapped up, was it late 2013?
That's right. We did it second half of last year, and it was marvelous, really wonderful. And of course, every night, you know, in front of the audience, for us, it was just a trip down memory lane. And Julie's career, of course, has been so extraordinary. She started as a child actor. She was, I think, 7 when she first appeared on stage with her parents. So, you know, we had that kind of same thing in common, and obviously we've both had our whole lives where The Sound of Music has been a huge influence on our lives and on people's, you know, the way people perceive us.
I'm sure you got a chance to tell her that story, that she kind of inspired you either on set or even now, but what was her reaction when you told her that she was the inspiration for you becoming an actor?
I think she was kind of a little bit taken aback. I don't think she'd realized that, but I think she thought it was really lovely and just one more link we had. And no, I used to tell that story to the audience on stage. And you know, I'm not sure whether everybody really quite believed it, but as I used to say, you know, there I was at 9 years old sitting in the back of the theater watching this woman, you know, being so brilliant. And 3.5 years later, I was in my pajamas on the end of the bed and she was singing My Favorite Things to me. You know, it was just unbelievable. It was just like something out of magic.
What was the show like, An Evening with Julie Andrews? What was that like for audiences? What were you able to do in the show?
Well, we were basically what we did. I mean, it was Julie's show, of course. I was the host of the show, and I was the person on stage with her, conducting the conversation with her. But there were a lot of film clips from her career, which obviously included clips with me in them. There were home movies that actually my mother had taken while we were making The Sound of Music, of kind of backstage at The Sound of Music and what we were all doing when the cameras weren't rolling. And then Julie herself told, some marvelous, wonderful, wonderful, and quite inspiring stories about her own life. And then we talked about some very personal things as well. You know, we talked about her, the challenges she's had since her throat operation and not being able to sing, and how she has, you know, kind of rechanneled her energies into writing books and making appearances where not as a singer. And, she's a woman who is so completely positive about life that even though, you know, as I said to her, and I used to say this to the audience, I used to say, look, you know, this is a woman who has won every award it's possible to win in any category you can think of, that has had every success. She's been made a dame by the queen. You know, there is nothing else that she can achieve. You would think at the age she was at, when she did lose the ability to sing, that most people would have just thought, you know what, I've done enough, I'm going to retire now. Instead, Julie just did a pivot. She's written 27 children's books with her daughter. She's a hugely successful author. She does the voices for the Shrek movies. She mm-hmm. does the Princess Bride movies. She's just kicked into a whole new career. And, you know, you thought, well, that's Julie. She just refuses to feel sorry for herself. She refuses to have any regrets. And I think that's, such an inspiration and a lesson to all of us. And I also would make the point, you know, because the question that I've always been asked, Joe, and I suppose all of us in The Sound of Music are asked, is, you know, what was the magic formula? Why is that one movie still loved by well over a billion people around the world and becomes more popular every year? And I've always said, if I had to put it in two words, Julie Andrews. I really think without her, I don't think we would still be talking about that film 50 years later. You know, I just think it was a stroke of genius casting her in that role. Let's remember, she was only 27 years old. She had never done a movie in Hollywood that had been released yet. She was an unknown. She had made Mary Poppins, but it hadn't come out. I was the only person on the film set who knew who she was. None of the crew knew who she were. None of the other kids knew who she were. And I knew who she was because I'd seen her on stage in London. So imagine that the weight on that girl's shoulders at the age of 27 to carry that movie. And 20th Century Fox was facing bankruptcy. And if that movie did not succeed, there would be no 20th Century Fox today. So
do you think it was just the level of talent that she possessed that just kind of got her through those nerves and just made her focus straight through?
I think it was that, but I also think it's exactly that same attitude that got her through this thing with the with her throat. Mm. And with it's just that sheer iron will determination and refusing to look on the negative, absolutely staying focused on the positive all the time. And I think that's what did it. I think that's what did it. And, you know, in a weird kind of a way, I think some of the lessons I learned from Julie, I tried to apply when I was playing Peter Parker, because I tried to play Peter as a guy who just had this thing thrust upon him that was not something he had ever wished for, that he'd never wanted to be different or better or stronger or have powers that his friends didn't have, but that now that it was given to him, he had to find a way to use it in the best way possible. And I tried to use those kinds of attitudes that I think Julie had instilled in me, which was, you just do the best with what you're given, and you always try to do something good and worthwhile. So I, you know, in my own way, I just tried to make Peter the kind of guy who, you know, he's just a decent human being. And now suddenly he's had this thing thrust on him. And, you know, he's not using it to go out and make himself rich. He's not using it to rob banks. He's not using it to even become, you know, famous and powerful and idolized by millions. You know, he doesn't want people to know who he is. And, you know, so I think there's a little bit of that quiet modesty that Julie has in her that I then tried to incorporate a little bit with Peter. And I hope it came across, because that was...
I wouldn't have thought of Julie Andrews as an inspiration for Spider-Man, but there's the connection.
Well, for me, it was. It wouldn't have been for anybody else, of course. But, you know, I'm sure more than once I would think of her while I was doing it and just think, you know, there she was. She just quietly goes about her business, even though she has this immense power and this immense gift. And yet you would never know from being with her that she was somebody other than just, you know, someone who's just quietly going through life doing the best they can. And I think that's kind of what Peter was as well. I think they've pretty much carried on with that in the film.
Yeah.
In the films that have been made.
There's an interesting take too, because when you think about the pilot that you shot for the Spider-Man television series, it's really different from the comic books. I mean, just the look, the feel, everything. But there's a key component that's missing of in the comic books and in the movies, his Uncle Ben is murdered. And he feels responsible for that. So that's kind of driving him along. You didn't have that. So it's interesting that you get that kind of Peter Parker is just like, what's the right thing to do in this situation?
Yeah, and you're right. That would have been a very interesting thing to add. And there was also the thing that I thought that it was, you know, I always felt there was a kind of a poignancy to the fact that he couldn't ever really allow anybody to get too close to him because it would just be too dangerous for them. So even when there were girls that he clearly was really attracted to and would have liked to have made a part of his life, it would always reach a point where he would know, well, if I let her into my life, then that means she becomes a target of all those people who would like to get at me. So in a way, you know, he's leading quite a lonely life. And it's that sort of loneliness that comes from the sense of moral responsibility that he knows that, you know, he's now in a position where he's kind of in danger all the time. And he just can't bring himself to allow anybody else to be put into that position, not anybody he cares about.
How did the role come to you? I mean, when did you first hear about it and how did you audition for it? How did that go?
It was the strangest thing. I was doing a play at the Mark Taper Forum in Los Angeles, which is a very good theater. And I was doing a play by Tom Stoppard called Travesties, which could not be further away from Spider-Man if you wanted to make it. I was playing the play takes place in 1920 in Zurich. And I was playing a European artist in the play. And apparently, the executives from CBS came to see me in the show, and I got a call to come in and meet them. And they said, so do you read Spider-Man comic books? I said, I've never read one in my life. They said, perfect. And I said, but I'm going to tell you right now, I mean, if you're asking me to be like an Incredible Hulk kind of guy, I just don't think I can do that. But if you want me to try to play him as a real person, as somebody who the audience forgets that he's got superpowers, and they just think they're watching the story of a real guy who's putting himself through college by working at a newspaper, I said, that I could do. They said, that's what we want.
Well, an interesting take right off the bat to show that they were trying to go. Do you think there was a sense that they were trying to get away from the comic books just because they knew they weren't going to have the budget to be able to pull some of that off?
I think that was probably some of it. You know, I mean, my God, you know, when you look back on that show, we were so limited. The technology, of course, was non-existent back then. And our budgets were so tiny, being TV budgets, that really we just had to make do with, you know, with what we could do. And I mean, Freddie, who did my stunts, you know, God bless him. I mean, you know, he didn't have the advantage of a lot of green screen and a lot of CGI. I mean, if there was a scene of Spider-Man coming out of the 69th story of the Empire State Building, they just opened the window and Freddie just went out the window on the 69th floor of the Empire State Building.
This is Freddie Waugh, the stuntman?
This is Fred Waugh, yes, who's, may he rest in peace. Unfortunately, he's just passed.
That's a few years ago, right?
Fred was he had been an acrobat with Ringling Brothers Circus. So, you know, he had incredible balance and he had no fear of heights at all. So you could put him on the edge of any building or, you know, suspend him from any building. And he was fine with that. And I remember it used to really irritate me because sometimes when the first episodes aired and people thought, oh, they must have just flipped the camera and that's not a real building. That's just somebody running, pretending to be running up a flat surface on the ground. And then they just flipped the film. And I thought, no, 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 never, not once ever. That's always a real building, a real roof. And it's either me up there doing a scene with other actors, or if it's, you know, if there's a stunt, then it's Fred.
Yeah, that's the amazing thing for people to kind of harp on the show and, you know, the cheesy factor and whatever. It's there's a guy on a building climbing a skyscraper.
Well, that's right.
For real. I mean, it's happening.
That's right. We didn't have the $30 million worth of computer generated imagery that the current Spider-Man films have, and they're brilliantly done. But I can promise you, they don't have Toby swinging from one building to another, you know, 100 stories up in New York City.
Well, there's an interesting thing when you watch the opening titles, and there's a shot of Freddy going up the side of the building. There's like one of the windows opens up and somebody sticks their head out and like looks up. So it's like, you know, that person was blown away by that.
Oh, I know. Well, actually, that's a funny story, because what I said before about the Empire State Building, that really did happen. And we just turned up, you know, on some floor that was, you know, some office of some company in the Empire State Building. And, you know, the secretaries are all there and everybody's working. And we just had one little corner of this floor where we were shooting. And you should have seen the looks on everybody's faces when all of a sudden they just opened one of the windows and Freddy just steps out the window.
Yeah.
You know, out onto the outside. And of course, he's got a harness and he's got, you know, cables and things. But still, you know, not many of us would want to just take a walk outside the Empire State Building.
No, fearless.
Or he's completely fearless. The irony was, is that, you know, we had really wonderful stuntmen, but I don't know if you remember, there was one movie for television we shot in Hong Kong. And I think it's called The Dragon's Challenge or something like that. And in it, there's a fight scene over the Hong Kong harbor. And we had all these fantastic kung fu fighters who had worked in all the Jackie Chan films, and they'd, you know, they'd worked in the Bruce Lee films. And these guys were really tough, really, really tough guys, and local Chinese stunt guys. And so they would do absolutely anything. I mean, amazing kicks and amazing fights. But then there was a moment in the script where one of them was supposed to get kicked and fall into the water. And they just looked at the director like, are you nuts? You think I'm actually going to go in the water in Hong Kong Harbor? You know, that was the one thing they refused to do. So I thought, oh, well, I don't think I'll be drinking out of that water anytime soon.
Script change.
Yeah, exactly. But it was such a great opportunity for me, because we did go to Hong Kong, we went to New York, we filmed in so many interesting places, and with some really wonderful guest stars that came on board. You know, we had Ted Danson and Morgan Fairchild and, you know, Thayer David, and, you know, some really wonderful actors.
Yeah, Joanna Cameron, a memorable performance.
Joanna worked on the show.
The Deadly Dust.
That's right, she did. And
she was ISIS. You know, now, was there any superhero talk on the set?
Oh, of course there was. And in fact, we kept saying, if we go another season, we've got to have ISIS. You know, we've got to have Spidey meet ISIS.
Did that actually conversation take place or not?
Oh yeah. And the other one, of course, that I always wanted to have happen, but we never. It was unfortunately impossible. Is, I don't know if you remember, but back in those days, they quite often used to do this kind of crossovers of shows. Like, for instance, you know, I mean, if there was a doctor show and a lawyer show that Universal were making, like, say, Marcus Welby, MD, for the doctor show, and Owen Marshall for the lawyer show, they would sometimes have Marcus Welby, the doctor, where he's taken into court and he appears on the other show.
Yeah.
And so there was like
Simon and Simon, Magnum P.I. Yeah,
exactly.
Murder, so She I Wrote, can, Magnum. Yep.
That's, you're exactly right. So I kept wanting for Bill Bixby and I to meet and have the Hulk and Spider-Man and them devise a show where Bill's character and my character, somehow their paths crossed. So you then had the Hulk and Spider-Man in the same episode working together. And sadly, Bill died.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you about, because there was talk of this happening. I was wondering how far it had gotten. Had you met Bill Bixby?
I had communicated with him and met him. I hadn't met Lou, but my producers had been talking to his producers, and of course we were both CBS shows, so it made a lot of sense. So I mean, of course, CBS loved the idea, but it was still just in the talk show stage because they, you know,
didn't get to scripting or anything like that.
Never got to script, unfortunately, because Bill died before that could happen, and then we were canceled. So it just was sad.
What could have been?
We didn't do well. It was very sad that Bill died, and to this day I've never met Lou, and I would like to, because you know I think it would just be fun to compare notes. Apparently, there's a big comic book show in New York, one of these conventions, you know, that they do, a sci-fi convention. I think it's called Comic Con or something like that, and they've invited me to come to that. So I was just thinking it might be fun to do. I've never done one of those. I've never gone to one of these sci-fi conventions and have a chance to really meet, you know, some of the real, real hardcore Spider-Man fans. I just think it would be very interesting to listen to their feedback.
I've been to a few of them, and it's you would be welcome with open arms. There's actually on the IndieCast is another podcast that I'm on. Mitchell Halleck, he runs Connecticut Comic Con, which is not too far from the New York Comic Con.
Oh, that's right.
So there you go. So there's another place where you would be welcome with open arms.
What's kind of you? Well, I've now reached the point where I get very interested in listening to what people's own reactions and hearing their stories about the show, and you know, people who grew up watching it or and now saying their kids watch it. And of course, I'm always being asked about when is it going to come out on DVD, and I just don't know the answer to that. The last I heard is that Disney owns the rights to it, and I would have thought, with the amount of interest there still is in that, in my series, that Disney would put it out on DVD. So perhaps they will someday, but I don't think a week goes by that I don't get half a dozen, you know, Twitter requests or questions on Facebook about, you know, when can we buy the DVD?
Well, we have our pristine VHS copies.
yes, exactly. That's what everybody has. If for anybody who still has a VHS machine.
Yeah. The Batman series just finally, all the legal wranglings, they got through those, and it's finally coming out on Blu-ray and DVD. So maybe Spider-Man is going to be next.
Well, I would hope so. I would hope so. I can't see why not. But anyway, maybe if enough people call up Disney and say we want to buy it, they'll do it.
The desire is there. Did you get a sense when you were shooting the show that like how big this was? Or you said you hadn't read the comic books, but did you get a sense of how huge this was?
Well, I'll tell you, when I first got it, Joe, is when the pilot aired, and the pilot got the highest rating of any show CBS had had on that year. I think we got a 37 share, and it was astronomical. I mean, nobody could believe, you know, it just went right through the roof. We beat the Waltons, we beat everything, all the shows that were the top rated CBS shows at the time. And I think it took them by surprise. I don't think they knew the extent of the fan base of the Marvel fan base and the Spider-Man fan base. And of course it was on the basis of that they ordered the series, because we shot the pilot as a TV movie and they were going to wait to see how it did before deciding to do any more. But when we got a 37 share, boy, I can tell you, we went straight into production to start doing more. And as I say, I mean, the fact that I, no matter where I go in the world, there are always still people that even all these years later recognize me from the show and want to talk about the show. And it's wonderful. I love hearing their stories, as I say.
As successful as it was then, what was the issue with it? Because the schedule was so haphazard. I mean, the episodes would air and then months would go by and you wouldn't see anything. What happened there?
Well, I really don't know. I mean, that was a network thing, and the network was going through some kind of internal upheaval of its own. And frankly, it was a great shame, because they lost their audience, because you literally could not find the show.
Yeah.
I mean, just when you would get used to it being on every Wednesday night at a certain time, suddenly, as you say, it would be off for a month.
We knew Hulk was on Friday night, every Friday night. I'm sitting in front, I knew when the Hulk was, and then Spider-Man, I'm like, where's my TV guide?
We started out on the same night, and when we played the same night, I think the first three or four episodes, the ratings were incredibly good every single time. Then I think they started getting a little too clever for their own good, and they thought, we've got a real powerhouse show here. We can use it to knock off the competition. So they kept moving it around and putting us up against whatever the top show was that NBC had or ABC had at the same time. Well, of course, that just did not work because our audience had no idea where we were. So then in typical network corporate mind think, suddenly our ratings dropped from 35 or 37 or whatever down to about 20. So then they come to us and say, what are you guys doing wrong? What you were so good 2 weeks ago. Why is nobody watching you anymore? And we're going, hello, nobody knows where we are, yeah. You know, and as I say, and then they finally just thought, well, this is, you know, we don't know if we can bring it back to life. So anyway, it was a pity. It was a real pity because we probably could have easily run another 2 or 3 years.
Oh, yeah.
But that said, look, as I say, I'm just very grateful I got a chance to do it. And it launched the character as a live character that, you know, led many years later to, you know, the successful movies being made.
Bigger and better things. What did you think of the suit itself? You were in it a little bit.
Oh, yeah, sure. As I say, about 20% of the time I was in the suit. Look, we went through a number of suits. It was a real learning curve on the suits because I don't think the wardrobe department had ever had to do anything like that before. And the first few we tried, they were really tricky. I mean, they were very, very hot to wear. The material didn't breathe at all. And also the eye lenses would fog up on the inside. So, you know, if you had to do something like be running as fast as you can down a street or up on a rooftop, it was pretty scary if suddenly you're like in the middle of a dead run and suddenly you can't see anything because your eyes just completely fog up. So then we'd have to stop and the suit would have to come off and it'd have to be, you know, wiped down. And then we tried doing eye things that had little tiny perforations in them. But that was hard to do without the camera being able to see them. So, by the time we'd done the show, by our second year, they'd found a kind of a Lycra that worked better. They found eye lenses that worked better. And again, you know, that's the kind of sad irony. We kind of just had it all really together by the time we got canceled. So, but it took all that time. So I was very curious to see when I saw the first movie with Toby. And I thought, oh boy, what I would have done for a suit like that. Because I mean, those suits look beautiful, absolutely beautiful.
A couple more bucks to spend on those ones.
Exactly, a few more, and probably a few more of them.
Yeah.
But the only thing I did like very much about the suit, and I notice it still seems to be a very popular little clip on YouTube, is I love the way the hood came off. And so when we did the scene in the pilot of the very first time I peel the hood off and you see it's me under it, you know, and I sort of laugh looking at myself, it was kind of wonderful because it was just like peeling off another skin. And it was like one skin on top of another skin.
Oh, as an actor, that's gotta just have so many layers to it.
Oh, it was wonderful. And I also love the episode, which was actually an episode that was my idea, where Spider-Man gets cloned. And so there are two of me. And so you have the dark side and the good side. And that was a really fun double character to play.
Now, I wanted to ask you about that one because were you aware that that was a very big story arc in the comic books? Not that exact story, but the cloning.
Yes, I had heard about that. I knew that this was coming out of what actually had come from the comics themselves. And it's funny that that particular episode is still one of the ones that most people talk about. So, it was a real pleasure to play that one.
What was it like to play to play both roles in that? Well, how did you kind of channel that as an actor?
You just have to decide it's a different character. You're playing two different characters. You try not to make it the same one, and you try to make them as distinctly different internally as you can. Obviously, you don't change your own external appearance. And then we did a lot of split screen stuff where, you know, if I'm talking to myself, you know, we would just have to shoot it twice, and you lock off the camera and you split the screen. So technically, it was, again, these days all those things are easier, but you know, technically it was a little bit more complex, but a really interesting and fun challenge because it just took me out of, you know, the Peter Parker that I played every other week. And it's always fun to play a bad guy.
It's a great episode. And one that you still watch today. And it's just like, some great visuals in that too. Do you still have the suit?
No,
version of the suit?
You know, I could kick myself. I was offered one, and at the time, I was just so sick of wearing it, and I just thought no. And Freddie wanted them, and I said, "You, by all means." And I think he sold a few of them on eBay, and because I know he did, because I actually had somebody come up to me in LA with the suit, with my own suit, and wanted me to autograph the back of it, which I did. And I remember asking him, and he said he bought it off of eBay. I hated to think.
Was there any part of you that was just like, how much do you want for it?
No. I wouldn't have wanted to buy it, but I did think, oh, you know, I wish I'd hung on to one. It would just be fun to have it hanging in the closet.
How about the tan corduroy jacket? Do you at least have that?
Do you know, I kept that for a long time, that jacket with the leather patches on the elbows. I kept it for a long time. It just finally wore out. But funnily enough, I did. I took the patches off, so I didn't want to walk down the street and have everybody think I was still in my wardrobe. But I took the patches off because I actually really quite liked that jacket. I mean, it was very 70s. I mean, you look now at the 70s clothes and you think, oh my God, is that really what we wore?
Yeah.
But you know, it's kind of fun in its own way.
Spider tracers, the web shooters, nothing hanging around the Hammond household?
No, unfortunately not. I didn't hold on to any of it. I've just got some really wonderful memories. I've got the great memories, though. What I do have, which is just personally meant a lot to me, is that the crew at the wrap party of the first season, they gave me a present where they had gone out to some stained glass master craftsman, and they had a stained glass window made of Spider-Man's face, just the head. Wow. Of Spider-Man, and you know, within the blue and green, in the blue and red suit, and a beautiful background, and that was a window for me to put into my house, and I did, and it's
oh, you still have that?
Yeah, I do, and that was a wonderful gift they gave me.
Oh,
so
fantastic!
That meant more to me than virtually anything, because we were a very tight group on the crew, and I loved my crew, and we all got on tremendously well. And my stand-in was a terrific actor in his own right, and he worked with me every single day, because you know you have to come in every morning ready to do 13, 14 pages of script, and you have to be word perfect, and you know, if you don't have somebody helping you, you're in trouble. So I was very lucky with a great crew and very good directors, and you know, so it was a very enjoyable experience, Joe.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that. Your supporting cast, really some great actors. It really just, you watch these things now and it's like that 70s newspaper feel, like, you know, you see these 70s, you know, movies and these dramas, and it really gives that great feel to it. You had the great Robert F. Simon as Jonah, Chip Fields as Rita Conway, Michael Pataki as Captain Barbera, Ellen Bry. What were these folks like to work with? Because it's such a great supporting cast.
Really good. Again, I was so lucky. I mean, yeah. Well, particularly with Bob and Michael, because which is not to take anything away from Chip and Ellen. They were great. But I also had. I had some wonderful people in the pilot, some other girls, you know, before Ellen came on. I had Rosalind Chow, who came with me to Hong Kong, who is a terrific actress, and Lisa Eilbacher.
People remember her from as Keiko O'Brien on Star Trek Deep Space Nine.
That's right. Yep. And in fact, this was her first job right out of USC. And I thought she was a very impressive actress. And I had Lisa Eilbacher play my girlfriend in the pilot. But, you know, Robert and Michael had done so much work, so much more than I had. And they were wonderful kind of real anchors to have. They were wonderful anchors to have on that show. And so, you know, I was just very, very lucky. I was very lucky. And they were great guys, too. I mean, Michael Pataki, one of the funniest men I've ever met in my life. And, you know, so
the comedic beats between the two of you, where his frustration is, just, yeah, I mean, you could feel the steam coming out of his ears as he's talking to you, and you're just like, hey, whatever.
And I know, well, and he was just a joy to be around. I mean, we had some very, very funny times together in New York and in L.A. And, I mean, oh. Well, we were a family. We really were. I used to go over to Michael's house for dinner, and you know, and Robert and I used to see each other all the time. And you know, no, it was great. It was just great.
Oh, great.
So anyway, so look, I'm glad people still enjoy it. I hope they continue to. And if it ever is out on DVD, I'll get one.
I'm sure they'll send you one. Hey, you mentioned the Tobey Maguire films. I read somewhere that you'd sent a letter to Tobey. when he was first started, and he never got it. Did you ever meet up with him or find out what happened to the letter or anything?
Look, I think the reason I say he never got it is because I never heard back from him, and I know I would have if he had. And look, it was my fault, probably. I just sent the letter to his agent, and I said, please pass this on to Toby, and maybe they just thought, oh, this is just another fan letter. I just wanted him to know that I was really happy they had hired him because, you know, I'd seen him do some other stuff, and I thought he was a terrific actor. And I just thought, you know, I just wanted to say I'm very happy to pass the torch to you and good luck, and I hope you have as much fun with it as I did. And I just wanted him to know that, you know, as far as I was concerned, I thought it was a great choice. And look, it wouldn't have mattered particularly probably to him. But if I do ever have the chance to run into him, I'll just tell him in person.
Yeah, that would be kind of cool. Maybe it'll be one of these comic book conventions. That'd be cool.
You know, and the other thing is I thought, you know, it would be fun someday if they ever do another one. And if they just said they wanted me to do 2 minutes in the background in a cameo.
I can't imagine that you're not in one of these already.
You'd think it would be fun, wouldn't it? I always thought, well, maybe it was just, and if they want me to be like his dad or his uncle or something like that, I thought, I know for the fans out there, they would just love that. They would love that. So you never know.
Well, you'd have to wrestle that away from Martin Sheen today, but.
Well, exactly. He's got it now, doesn't he?
But anyway. Hey, like a police officer or, you know, one of the guys that goes after Spidey or something like that, or police captain. Yeah.
Just anything. It could be a guy sitting in a coffee shop just at the next table, just looking over and giving a little nod. And
And Stan Lee sitting there having coffee. Come on, this is a no-brainer.
That's right. You'd think so. You'd think so, just for the fun of it. Anyway,
hopefully
perhaps we will.
What do you think of the new movies? Have you had a chance to check them out, or do you kind of like stay away from that?
No, that's not. I've seen all of them except the last one. I saw the ones that Toby did, and I thought they were terrific. And I'm told that the new guy, whose name now escapes me,
Andrew Garfield.
That's right, Andrew Garfield. Somebody said he bears more of a resemblance to you than Toby did, and they thought perhaps maybe they were going more back towards the kind of look for Peter that we had in the series. I have no idea if that's true. But again, he's a very, very good actor. What I like is the fact that with the movies, they've continued the tradition that we had, which was basically getting an actor, not an action hero, to play Peter Parker. And, you know, because both Andrew Garfield and Tobey Maguire, first-rate actors in their own right, long before they ever played a superhero. And just as Christopher Reeve was when he was hired to play Superman, you know, he really started that tradition of them getting an actor who is a serious actor, who's got a long list of serious credits on stage, on film, on television. And he's not just somebody who's, you know, has won a weightlifting contest, but he's actually somebody who knows how to carry a scene and carry a storyline. So anyway, I welcome seeing the next movie, and I'm sure I will. I usually watch them when I'm on the plane, and it's a lot of fun.
It's a long flight from Australia, isn't it?
It is, but you know, I do it back to LA so often.
You can watch all the Spider-Man movies on the plane.
I can. It's still my spiritual home.
I think you'll get a kick out of them because they're really delving into the Peter Parker mythology. There's a mythology coming in with his family and his father who isn't on the scene, and what was he into? So yeah, they're really delving into that, which is kind of cool. So it's a big trip for an actor, I would imagine. So,
well, I will, Joe.
Yeah, it'd be kind of cool. So let's talk about what's going on now. Current projects, what are you working on now?
I'm about to do a film called Cycle here in Australia. That's Cycle as in bicycle. That's a story about me who goes to Europe and is kind of at the stage in his life where he's wondering what his life's all about. It's, as I keep saying, it's like the baby boomer form of Easy Rider. Instead of being 20 years old on a motorcycle, you're 60 years old on a bicycle, but it's the same thing. It's looking for what matters in your life. And it's a really lovely film. I write a lot these days. I've got three projects I'm doing for two different studios in LA and one for a company out here, film projects. So I've got three scripts on the go, and I just shot a little movie here, also in Australia, where, an action film, called Turkey Shoot. So I just keep my hand in all the time, both in front of the camera and behind the camera these days. But I'm still doing, I haven't changed from when I first auditioned from Lord of the Flies. I'm still just in the same business and making my living, you know, in the movie business.
Channeling Julie Andrews and being inspired by her all the way, right?
I absolutely am. And I will as long as I can. I look at Christopher Plummer. He's 84 and he's still winning Academy Awards. And I think, well, there's the inspiration. You know, I had two pretty amazing people playing my parents in that film, and they're pretty good role models, I think.
Oh, it's legendary. So where can fans find out more about these projects? Do you have a website, or how can they find out where they can see them or when they're coming out?
Yeah, well, if they just Google my name, you know, there's usually an awful lot of stuff about what I'm doing coming up on that, or they can follow me on Twitter, and, you know, and my Twitter account keeps publishing those things. So
what's your Twitter account?
It's just Nicholas Ham 1.
Nicholas Ham 1.
That's it, at Nicholas Ham 1. And if they want to follow me, and then they can find out everything I'm doing.
Oh, that'd be fantastic too. So, and you mentioned possibly some convention appearances coming up in 2014.
Well, if I get invited, and if they want me to be there, I'd be very interested to see if I can fit them into a schedule, because, you know, I would love to have an opportunity now to talk to the people, particularly the Spider-Man fans. And somebody told me that there's a cruise ship that does a sci-fi cruise. And I thought, well, that might be interesting too, to go and meet all the people, you know, be on there with like other people from other shows, like, you know, if Linda Carter's on, or, you know, somebody from, you know, Wonder Woman, or somebody from, or, you know, Isis or whatever.
Lou Ferrigno.
Lou Ferrigno, you know, and I don't know whether that's actually true or that was just somebody's wishful thinking that there would be a cruise, a sci-fi cruise. But I thought, well, you never know. If I'm asked, I will go if I can fit it in with what else I'm doing. So maybe somebody will ask me.
Maybe we can get that long hoped for Spider-Man Hulk team up.
Oh, wouldn't that be cool? All right.
That would be great. So, well, Nicholas, you brought a very human quality to a superhuman role, and you gave us a memorable web slinger. Thank you so much for that.
Say thank you for asking me to appear on your show.
Oh, thanks for being here. We really had a great time. Thank you so much.
That's my pleasure. All right. All the best to you.
My VHS copies of The Amazing Spider-Man are nice to have, but come on, a DVD Blu-ray release is way overdue. We've got the entire CBS Hulk series, we've got a double feature of the CBS Captain America TV movies, they're on DVD, and the 1990 Captain America film as well. It's high time Spidey got his dues. Hopefully soon. My thanks again to Nicholas Hammond for joining me today. To find out what Nicholas is up to next, be sure to follow him on Twitter, at Nicholas Ham 1. Nicholas Ham 1. And be sure to follow Comic Book Central on Twitter at ComicBookCTRL. Give it a like on Facebook at facebook.com/ComicBookCentralNetwork. Be sure to hashtag share the lair with your friends and family, and catch every episode of the show online at comicbookcentral.net. Or, better yet, subscribe to the show on iTunes. Rate and review the show while you're there. It only takes a minute and it's always appreciated. You can also email your thoughts about the show too. joe@comicbookcentral.net. Would love to hear from you, and I'll be sure to read your email on the show. Well, folks, like a web shooter that has run out of web fluid, that's all I got for today. But I promise to lock and load another cartridge, because next week on Comic Book Central, another spandex-clad hero will be paying a visit to the lair. This time I will be chatting with the greatest American hero, William Catt. Now, I'm not sure if he's going to have the little red jammies with him or if little green men will show up, but I promise you this is definitely going to be another entertaining show. Until then, have a marvelous week. Keep reading those comics, and thanks for joining me here in the lair, Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life. This podcast is intended for entertainment and education purposes only. All original content of this podcast is the intellectual property of Comic Book Central and is licensed under Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivations 3.0 Unported License. All of the content and names are registered trademarks and copyrights of their respective holders.
I have to tell you something. You see, I'm afraid I have to break our date for Saturday night.
Break our date?
Yeah. Well, you see, something suddenly came up.